Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Well, hello, it's Wednesday, the 7th of October, and this is Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index, brought to you by me, David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service. How are you this morning, Phil?
I'm very well indeed, David. How are you doing?
Well, I'm pretty well as well. Yes, I'm feeling fairly chipper, I suppose, for a Wednesday morning, middle of the week. But it's been quite an interesting week so far in terms of news. You remember last week, any listeners who listened to last week's podcast, it was all about biodiversity. We had a guest, Stephanie Ray, an ecologist, with us, had a very lively conversation. And in fact, that theme seems to have continued over into this week, because no sooner had we done that podcast that Boris Johnson stood up at the virtual Tory party conference and announced a wonderful package of measures to make us all reliant on wind power by the year, I can't remember which year it was, soon anyway.
Well, but these issues of sustainability and green and ecology and everything, they're only becoming ever more important and more crucial. We have a climate emergency, after all. And
so
even
told.
The royal family is, well, the royal family has always been enthusiastic proponents of ecology and conservation. But
well, certain members have.
Yeah, prominent ones. But it's, Boris's speech yesterday, what do you make of it?
Well, it's like he's turned green all of a sudden, because I've never really thought of Boris Johnson as being much of an environmentalist. It hasn't really struck me as being his bag, really. But, I mean, a week or two ago, he was talking at this UN conference, wasn't he? This biodiversity summit in New York. I don't think he was actually in New York. It was all remotely done. And he pledged to protect 30% of UK land for nature as a boost for biodiversity. And in fact, Stephanie Ray did mention this last week. And now he said he wants to increase the UK's target for offshore wind power capacity by 2030, upping it from 30 gigawatts to 40 gigawatts. He's earmarked £160 million in order to do that, upgrading ports and factories to build wind turbines. So he has this idea that we're all going to be using, I don't know if he means exclusively, wind power in our homes.
Because, I mean, we're building a huge... Yeah, the idea that it's exclusively wind power is, of course, completely bogus.
Yes, it's nonsense.
We're building this great big nuclear power station down in Somerset at the moment. There's other nuclear power stations that are supposedly in the pipeline, but looking increasingly likely they might never happen.
Yeah.
And there's solar power being pushed left, right and centre, particularly on local projects. And the idea that it's all going to be wind, you know, powering every kettle in every home.
Yeah. Well, he did. I love the way he couched it. It's typical Boris Johnson sort of schoolboy banter. He said, by 2030, all your appliances will get their juice cleanly and without guilt from the breezes that blur around these islands. Which is just bluster, isn't it? I mean, I think Hinkley Point is actually quite a windy place, but they're building nuclear power there, as you point out. But anyway, that's the idea. And I mean, the good thing for the construction industry is that he reckons that his plan will create 2,000 new jobs in the sector and support 60,000 more, although I don't know whether those are construction jobs that he's talking about. Certainly the 2,000 are construction jobs.
But do you know what excites me about wind power is from a construction point of view, it's not about the clean energy is great and all of that, but actually, now all that wind power is happening offshore, we don't really see what's going on.
No.
We used to see and either admire or complain about these rather statuesque wind turbines spinning or standing idle around the country as we moved around. But the action's now taking place offshore. It's out of sight and out of mind, a bit like the oil rigs that you just are there, we know about, but we never see them, so don't think about them.
Well,
the construction of oil rigs was a technical feat, and the development there. And similarly, these offshore turbines that are going up, what fascinates me, and the onshore ones, is the way that, first of all, there are innovations in the foundations and the anchoring of them into the ground, and now they're going to be floating turbines, the new generation. And secondly, as you know, I used to work on a crane magazine, so I have an interest in lifting equipment. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the development of the fact that wind turbines got higher and higher, initially onshore, has been made possible by the developments in lifting technology and crane design. An awful lot of the big crane manufacturers, their most interesting innovation in the first part of the 21st century was specifically for the lifting nacelles onto the top of these ever higher wind turbine masts. And I mean, maybe that's a subject for another day, innovations in lifting technology that we've seen over the past 20 years, but there have been plenty of them. So there are construction innovations which are driven by wind power.
Yes,
and
that's true.
As the Prime Minister talked about, these innovation centres, I think it's in the northeast or the east coast anyway. These innovation centres relating to wind power, and transporting these things around as well. There's some quite wacky, crazy looking trailers and dolly rigs and things for moving these huge great turbine masts around,
and the blades. Right? Yes, absolutely. Also, the way they bring the electricity to shore, because of course you need cables, so there's a lot of cable laying. I think in North Kent, not a million miles away from you, they had a few problems because, of course, I think they overcame the problems, but it was a bit of a challenge because they were bringing these new cables across the North Sea or the Thames Estuary, coming ashore somewhere near Sheerness, I think. I might be wrong about that. But I do know that the Thames Estuary is absolutely littered with unexploded ordnance from the Second World War. And so they had to be particularly careful about that. That's another interesting topic as well, is how you avoid getting blown up by ancient ordnance. We haven't written about that in the past. But yes, I think that was a problem with that. I'm not sure. I would take issue with your assertion that offshore wind power is out of sight and out of mind. It might be for me certainly, and for the majority of people living inland. But if you go down, if you were to get in your car and drive for an hour, Phil,
you're going to tell me to go to Whitstable
or Faversham
and Bay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I regularly, I'm less than an hour away from Whitstable, and there's some lovely dog walks down there on the on the seafront, and I'll go down there and Reculver Castle and places. Yes, you do see them, but they're sort of the first generation. They're pretty small fry compared to what's going on now, I think, is my understanding.
Yeah.
You can see them. There are mixed views about whether they are a scar or adding to the beauty.
Interesting. Well, I mean, I grew up in Margate, and I seldom go back. But on the last time I did, it really was noticeable because I walked down to the end of the road where my parents used to live, and there was this corridor of turbines stretching out to sea, which is very odd because they're all lined up. As you walk along, they all suddenly come into line, and you cannot avoid it. Out of the corner of your eye, you suddenly see this thing appear, like an illusion caused by the coincidence of this row of turbines. All of a sudden, they're all lined up, and you can't miss it. I think a lot of people probably think it's rather nice to look at. I found it rather disturbing myself, but there you are. It's clean energy, and we should be all in favour of it. So. And of course, clean energy is what everybody is about these days, including the construction industry. We're cleaning up our act left, right and centre, aren't we?
Yeah, well, one of the areas that one of the sectors that's doing a lot in this regard is the building materials side, specifically concrete.
Yes.
I don't know if you remember, about a year ago or 18 months ago, the Guardian newspaper had a huge week-long, almost a campaign against concrete. I mean, it was at the edges saying, what an awful lot of wonderful things have been built by concrete, and the concrete is used to keep at bay the forces of nature, to protect us from floods and so on. And so concrete clearly does good things, but it's saying that concrete's responsible for 8% of the world's emissions of carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
After water, it's the most widely used substance on the planet, which is an interesting assertion. It'd be interesting to, after a few beers, to think of other substances which are used more than concrete. There must be something used more than concrete. I don't know. And it said if the cement industry were a country, it would be the third largest CO2 emitter in the world.
That is incredible, isn't it?
China and USA. 2.8 billion tonnes of carbon dioxide is emitted by the cement industry.
Yeah.
Directly and indirectly, I guess. Now, we're not... UK is small fry and all of this. China uses almost half of the world's concrete, apparently.
Yeah, no surprise there.
But, I mean, the cement industry, the concrete industry, they know. They are fully sensitive and aware of what needs to be done. And by and large, I mean, we can always say they're not doing it quick enough. We can always level these accusations at people, but they seem to be doing quite a lot, don't they?
Yes, concrete and cement. Cement, obviously, being the component of concrete that really is responsible for carbon emissions. I think I've been looking at the same figures as you actually, Phil, because the amount of concrete production has been increasing massively over the last sort of 30, 40 years. Apparently, it's leveled out. This is according to, I think the figures come from...
The global figures you're looking at.
Yeah, the
at,
global
aren't they?
Figures. Yeah, they are.
Well, that produced by China, some Dutch.
Yes, that's right. So between, I don't know. Let's just look. I'm looking at a graph here.
Millions of tons.
It's about between 4 billion and 4.5 billion tons a year being produced at the moment. And back in 2002.
Of cement or concrete? Cement, is that?
Cement, but in 2002 it was only 1.5 billion tons per year. So you can see it's been increasing massively. The interesting thing about this story, this week's story, is that the UK concrete sector is actually UK Concrete, which is part of the Mineral Products Association. They have announced this really ambitious plan to become net carbon negative by 2050. Which means removing more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere than it actually emits. I've no idea. Well, I do have an idea how they plan to do this, because they say they're going to do it by decarbonizing electricity. We're back to wind power and renewable energy here. Transport networks, fuel switching, and greater use of low carbon cements and concretes. I mean, we're talking about byproducts like ground granulated blast furnace slag and pulverized fuel ash, which of course is in a dwindling supply these days. But do you think they could do it? Do you think they could be carbon negative by 2050?
If you're chucking loads of cement into the foundations of wind turbines,
yeah.
Does the clean energy generated by the nacelle at the top and the turbine, does that counteract and make the cement at the base carbon positive?
Eventually.
If that's how it works, that's like cooking the books, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, this is it. I mean, a lot of the time when people talk about renewable energy and wind power, I think is probably the best example, is you have to build these things. You have to use steel, hydrocarbons, plastics, which are derived largely from oil, of course, and of course cement and aggregate to actually create and install a wind turbine. So that wind turbine has to generate a certain amount of electricity carbon-free for, I don't know, somebody's done the sums, a certain number of years before it's paid off the carbon which is emitted in its production, in its manufacture and installation. I'd like to see the figures on that. I'm sure they're probably available. I haven't found them.
I bet neither you or I would understand them.
No, you're probably right.
There'll be some sigmas and x cubes in there, yeah. And things. But anyway, I mean, however it's calculated, I bet that in 10 years' time, as we get nearer nirvana, the formulae, the algorithm will be cranked up so that we have to continually improve. One is never allowed to settle for where one's at in anything in life, sadly. I quite fancy settling, but we're never allowed to settle for anything as good enough. But what is happening and is... where progress is properly being made is cement substitutes. And some of these are a bit old school. I mean, the GGBS, ground granulated blast furnace slag, has been around for, how long has it been around? Certainly, well, as long as you and I have been writing about.
Well, since Bessemer, I suppose. I don't know. When do they start to...
But as a cement substitute, though.
Oh, as a cement substitute. Well, certainly, as long as I've been writing about construction, it's been used. I mean, it was an economic decision to use it originally, I suppose. But now, of course, the benefit is largely environmental. But, of course, it's a mistake to assume that ground granulated blast furnace slag and PFA are themselves zero carbon, because they're the byproduct of very carbon intensive processes
very dirty
themselves.
Things. Yeah, presumably PFA is not going to be around for much longer if we're not going to have coal fired. Well, we don't have coal fired. Do we have any coal fired power stations? What stage is that at? They're certainly on their way out, aren't they?
They are. I don't know if you've got any in the UK now. I know in Eastern Europe they still burn coal, but I think you're right. It is definitely on its way out. The interesting thing about PFA is that there are stockpiles around the place in various locations in the UK, and they're now being disinterred. It's almost like they're being mined.
Oh, right. That's
because they've been stockpiled for years and years and years, and they've just been sitting there. Now people are digging them out again and refining the stuff and using it for cement substitutes. So, quite ironic, really, in a way.
We've reported on Construction Index website, news pages, about two major cement manufacturers who've come up with, who've come up with a low-carbon concrete using alternatives to cement. Cemex have got something called Virtua Classic Zero, which sounds like a Diet Coke drink or something, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Virtua Classic Zero. I think Kia used it on a student accommodation project at Warwick University.
Okay.
Earlier this year or last year. And it's been used for the first time in London at an HS2 site in London. Costain Skanska JV and Leiden Contracting were paying the ground for an electricity substation that will power the TBMs. They've used Cemex Virtua Classic Zero to reduce the carbon content of that part of the project.
Yeah.
I've got a bit of promotional blurb about the Cemex product. It achieves a 30 to 50% CO2 reduction over standard concrete mix, CEM1. And then they can crank that up to 100% carbon eliminated by giving some money to a carbon offsetting organisation.
Oh, we know all about that.
But, you know, if it's 30 to 50% CO2 reduction, big, you know, pat on the back there.
Mm.
And funnily enough, exactly the same reduction is claimed by Aggregate Industries, which is that Lafarge Holcim, I think?
I can't keep
Industries,
up with that. Yeah.
They keep changing, don't they? With its new EcoPact range. And this is quite cunning. They've got a regular EcoPact, uses a blended cement to give 30 to 50% CO2 reduction. And then you've got EcoPact Prime, an engineered low-carbon concrete with what we talked about before, ground granulated blast furnace, slag and fly ash substitutes to crank up the reduction, CO2 reduction to 70%. And just like your Virtua Classic Zero, you can crank it up to 100% carbon neutral by giving them some money.
Yeah,
for offsetting. So,
right.
But anyway, these products are there to lower, to reduce the impact of carbon on concrete using better cements. I don't know if they are better. It'd be interesting to see whether in, you know, 30 years' time, whether walls made of or structures made using the doctored cement performs as well as the old-fashioned carbon-intensive cement.
Well, we ought to ask BRE about that, I suppose, because I'm sure they must have done some studies on accelerated aging, that kind of thing. And of course, there have to be, don't there, technical standards for inclusion in any structural material. Yeah, I don't know if over time they just dissolve into a sludge or whether they're just as good as cement in the long term. But I don't know. I mean, talking about UK Concrete and its ambitious plan to become net carbon negative by 2050, I don't see them talking about offsetting, but I'm sure that in order to achieve that, they're going to have to do some offsetting, aren't they? They can't just do it
isn't
by...
Off- offsetting is just marketing, though. It's not a solution. It's marketing.
No, that's right. Yeah, but that is what's always quoted, isn't it? As a, you know, as a way of reducing your carbon footprint, offsetting always comes into the mix because, in a way, I suppose if nothing else, it's a way of making up any genuine shortfall. I always go back to the first time I heard about carbon offsetting, and I really became cynical about it was when Coldplay said that they were going to, that one of their albums was going to be carbon negative.
Coldplay or Radiohead? That sounds more like a Radiohead.
No, this was Coldplay. This was years. Okay. This was years ago. And yeah, this is in the days of CDs before downloads. Every time somebody bought one of their CDs, they were going to plant a tree. And I just had this mental image of somebody going in and getting a list from their local retailer. Right, okay, we've sold so many copies, and then just going out with a spade and some saplings and planting the trees for somebody. But
what was that line about every time Bono claps, something or other dies?
I don't know. I haven't heard that one.
The shout went out, well, stop bloody clapping then.
Yeah. So clean energy and clean building materials and decarbonising the construction sector. There's Rishi Sunak's got a plan to decarbonise the plant industry, hasn't he, Phil? And it's not going down particularly well.
About, okay, yeah, this is red diesel.
Red diesel, rebate. That's the one. Yes.
Construction's tax rebate for diesel is going. Now, we talked about this at some length after the budget in our podcast of the 12th of March. So if anyone's interested in the topic of diesel usage in the construction industry and alternatives and so on, scroll back or down or however you find it for our 12th of March chat. But why it's in the news again this week, essentially the consultation, Rishi Sunak announced in the budget in March that he'd already said he was going to end the tax rebate that the construction industry enjoys for off-highway machinery for the diesel that they use. That was going to be scrapped in April 2021. And last minute lobbying from the construction industry said, all right, I'll put it back to 2022 then, the scrapping the rebate, and we'll have a consultation on it just to sound things out. That consultation period is now finished. And the broad thrust of what the construction industry is saying is, no, please don't. It's going to be expensive. We can't afford it. Nothing is essentially changed except, of course, for COVID. So they're going, no, please don't. It's going to be expensive. COVID, we can't afford it. So the arguments remain the same.
When was the original plan to introduce it? Wasn't it in the budget next year? March next year, was it?
I think, I can't remember whether it was November, 18 months ago, a while ago, he said he was going to, or maybe it was in the press leaks, the trailing in the press before the 2020 budget. It was said that he was going to scrap the red diesel rebate in April 2021.
Right,
and
okay.
He's conceded that farmers can carry on having it, but construction, it's going to go in April 2022. Mm. As a recap to people not so familiar with what red diesel is, normal diesel with a bit of dye in it to make it look different so that we know that it's taxed at a lower rate. Red diesel is taxed at 11.14 pence per litre, as opposed to the standard rate of 57.95. It's 46 pence a litre discount that the construction industry gets for its machines. And the argument is, quite valid one it seems to me, is why should the construction industry be getting taxpayer subsidy to be using, you know, to promote the use of dirty machines when this is 10% of fuel pollution comes from construction sites, I think it's a figure or some such. The argument that goes against that is that, well, it's not quite viable yet to use alternatives. There's an awful lot of work being done on alternatives.
Yeah.
But diesel in 2020, or at least the diesel machines, the EU Stage 5 engines, are infinitely cleaner than they were 20 years ago. Anyway, what the construction industry is saying basically is, we can't afford it, please don't. Or let's have a roadmap, let's make it part of a strategy to phase it out. And there's some sound reasons behind that. But I just wanted to flag up something which I haven't heard anyone say out loud, and it seems the piggy and obvious solution is what we should be saying to the Chancellor is not, oh, don't scrap this taxpayer subsidy that we benefit from because everything's going to get more expensive. Don't say, oh, can you give us another 2 years? We're not ready yet, because you'll never be bloody ready, folks.
No.
The sensible thing to do, it seems to me, is that when the landfill tax came in, everyone squealed like pigs, but actually we knew that landfill tax kind of made sense, and as a tool, as an instrument, it has achieved its objectives and has gone a long way to reducing waste going to landfill, which is a good thing.
Absolutely.
So in the same way, I mean, the landfill tax didn't come in, I don't know what the landfill tax per tonne is, but it's a lot more now than it was when it first came in. It was gradually cranked up as the industry geared itself up. Now, it seems to me the obvious way forward for Rishi Sunak is not to scare the horses, is just to put an extra 5p on the tax of red diesel a year for the next 5 years, 7 years, so that gradually it becomes...
You phase it out.
I mean, exactly, just a little bit a year. It'll get more expensive, and each year is a little bit of pain, but it's all spread out. I mean, diesel itself is a fuel in general. Didn't that, not very long ago, used to go up God knows how much every year as a matter of course?
Yes.
Just like fags go up every year as a matter of course, because fags and petrol are bad things and we should tax them to hell. But then that seemed to be, you know, got to a certain stage where the political outcry won out, and the rising price of petrol, it now seems to float around with the, you know, the price of a barrel of oil in OPEC rather than what the Chancellor wants to do. But the forever cranking up of fuel tax seems to have subsided. But I don't see why they can't just add a little bit onto the red diesel tax each year to achieve what they want to achieve over a longer time frame without doing the damage that they're going to do if they do it all in one big hit.
Do you know if anybody's officially proposed that as an alternative?
Yeah, me, here, now.
Yeah, I know you have, but has it been suggested in Parliament, and has Rishi Sunak rejected it for some reason? Because I'd like to know what his reasons would be.
I haven't heard anyone say that.
No.
It just seems so pig and obvious, doesn't it?
It does, really, yeah. And, well, there's another
on
story.
On the subject of green transport, what are you going to say next?
Yeah. Well, I got a press release last week, which to begin with, I thought it was a bit odd, really, because FM Conway, which is a contract which specialises in sort of road maintenance, basically, they've decided that they are going to adopt electric bikes, which doesn't sound like the sort of policy that you'd expect a contractor to adopt, but they're talking about special types of electric bike and in specific applications.
They don't think they've decided to adopt. They've bought two and they're seeing what they're like.
Yeah. Well, the thing, the point is...
They borrowed them off a mate, to be honest. Yeah.
I don't know. But, well, I did ask them about this and they did get back to me and gave me some more information. Well, the point is, first of all, FM Conway has already stated a pledge to become carbon neutral by 2045. So they've got their target to meet. They do a lot of work in central London. An awful lot of their work is on the road network in London. And London, of course, is not a good place for road transport because, first of all, it's very congested. And to alleviate that, you've got the congestion charge. And it's also an ultra low emission zone. So if you've got lots of...
And you can't park anywhere.
You can't park anywhere. You're absolutely right. So if you run a fleet of diesel vans to move plant and materials around to your various sites, a lot of these sites, of course, are very small because they're road surfacing, resurfacing, that kind of thing, in urban districts. If you've got a fleet of vans servicing these sites, you've got a bit of a headache from the transport point of view. And so what they thought they would do was experiment. So they bought two bikes, and these bikes are made by a company called Urban Arrow, which I've never heard of before. And they're supplied by an organisation called Fully Charged, which I've also never heard of before. But they're at fullycharged.com, so you can find out about them. They bought two of these bikes, each one costing £5,000, so they're not cheap. And these bikes, they're not just bikes to get people to and from work. They are cargo bikes. And so they've got this rather strange arrangement that in front of the handlebars is a flat cargo space, like a mini flatbed. And beyond that, so sticking out in the front, a couple of metres in front of you, is the front wheel. So there's obviously some sort of clever linkage between the handlebars and the front wheel because they're not directly connected. And these bikes are electric, so they are sort of pedal-assisted electric bikes, and they can carry up to 250 kilograms on this flatbed, which I was quite impressed about. I mean, 250 kilograms is a lot to be cycling around London with. So they say, you know, you can, if you left your cut-off saw in the depot and you get to site and think, oh dear, I need that, you can hop on your bike, go back and get it. And you can travel on the bike network. So you've got the cycle lanes throughout London. So you don't get caught in the traffic. And you can nip off and get it. Or if you need an extra bag of sand or cement, you can go and get that.
I can imagine you can drive your empty bike back to the yard to pick up your spanners or your bag of chips or whatever more quickly than you could in a van.
Absolutely, yeah.
But 200, you said it's got a quarter of a ton payload.
Yes.
So you're cycling on a two-wheel bike, not even a three-wheeler, is it? It's a two-wheel bike.
No, it's two wheels.
With a quarter of a ton. Now, I have seen in parts of the world entire families of five fitting on certainly scooters and occasionally push
bikes. Oh, yes, it can be done.
I wouldn't fancy it.
Well, I don't know how fast these things go. I don't own an electric bike, but I have borrowed one before, and I was very impressed by... the motor is almost invisible. It's tiny, and the battery isn't all that big. And yet,
do they have a retarder? Surely you can go as fast as you can on a regular push bike, can't you, if you pedal fast enough?
Absolutely. You can go faster. I mean, they do... The bike that I used did have a limiter, so you couldn't go more than, I don't know, I think it was 30 miles an hour. I can't remember. You know, 30 miles an hour is plenty fast enough on a bike, thank you very much. And
with a quarter of a ton on the front.
With a quarter of a ton of cement, yeah. But, yeah, they're incredibly powerful, these little motors. And so I'm not at all surprised to hear that you, especially in London, which isn't a particularly hilly place, really, that you can bowl along with a quarter of a ton of cement on your bike. But as you say, I don't know.
But if you spill that load...
Yeah.
And you've got, whether it's sand or cement or what, you know, whatever it is, but a quarter of a ton of load over the cycle lane and perhaps sort of, you know, spilling over into the bus lane.
Yeah.
It's quite a high risk of that, I would have thought.
Well, I would have thought so as well. I'm assuming that these bikes have got good brakes. But yes, if you're on a two-wheeler and, you know, you have to corner very suddenly to avoid somebody else, I don't know, you could easily pitch your load off. Getting it back on might be a bit of a problem if it's in one lump.
Yeah, manual handling and all of that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I imagine that you must have a bike stand that you can flip down so that you can stand the bike up and then reload it. I don't know. But I think it's quite interesting. The company...
it is interesting.
Yeah, they're using it, they're phasing it. They're trialling it on phase two of the Illuminated River project, which isn't a project which we've looked at in any great depth so far, but it does mean that they're sort of working up and down the river for Westminster City Council. So
it's the bridges, isn't it? They're illuminating the bridges. Is that
right? Something like that. I don't really know much about it. Maybe we ought to take a closer look. But it's a sort of thing which I suppose it's probably a very linear site. So there's probably a lot of up and downing with, you know, small consignments of tools and materials. So I can understand that these bikes might be quite good. They did send me some clarification. He said the bikes are running journeys on average of about 10 minutes, whereas a van would take two or three times that. So I suppose, you know, getting in the traffic and then standing still at the lights.
So probably just talking about going from bridge to bridge, I guess.
Yes, I would have thought
so. Between the bridges. So
yeah.
That makes sense, yeah.
So I mean, if you think about sort of going along the embankment or somewhere like that, yeah, I'm sure you could get... You could get from A to B much quicker on a bike than you could in a van because the traffic's just a nightmare. So, yeah, they're effectively two or three times as fast as a van.
You actually go from C to A to B on the embankment, from Chelsea to Albert to Bath.
Yes, that's true. Yes, well spotted. Ironically, one of the biggest tests of these bikes and their capabilities was during the Extinction Rebellion demonstrations of, was that in August, July, August? I can't remember when it was. FM Conway say all our vans were stuck in traffic all day, whereas our bikes continue their journeys almost without restriction. So they say that they're using these bikes to future-proof their logistics network before further carbon stroke emissions restrictions are in place in central London and the surrounding areas. And they're also, as you've pointed out, they've got the benefit of no parking costs, no congestion charge, and no ultra-low emission zone problems. So, yeah, apart from the possible dangers of falling off your bike with a quarter of a ton of cement on the front, yeah, I imagine it's got quite a lot going for it.
Not quite so radical, but Speedy, the tool hire people, have done something also in an electric vehicle. They've got an electric taxi that they've rigged up in London.
Oh, it's a London cab, isn't it? It's a black cab.
Yeah, the standard London electric vehicle company trialling see if this electric taxi is a viable alternative to a regular diesel one-ton van.
What's that? Is that to get the chief executive around town?
Well, it's got blacked out windows. Well, I think it's got red, speedy coloured out windows in the back. I think it's to deliver tools to customers.
So same thing, yeah. So does it get all the benefits that a black cab gets? Because of course there are certain lanes which only black cabs can use in London. So
which is why Prince Philip and Stephen Fry have them.
Isn't
that what we've heard?
According to urban legend, I don't know if that's true, but. I was once picked up by a taxi by a black cab driver who looked just like Prince Philip once, and I don't know if it was actually him, but I'd like to think it was. His driving was much better than Prince Philip's, according to what I've read more recently. Anyway, yeah, so I think it's quite a novel idea, and I'll be interested to see if they decide to adopt it more widely. Two bikes is a drop in the ocean, of course, so they'd need a few more than that, and also £5,000 for a bike is I think you can spend £5,000 quite easily on a bike these days, can't you?
But talking of novel ideas, £5,000 on a bike or £96,000 on a bouncy castle?
Yeah, well, I know what you're talking about, and I must admit I struggle to see how a glorified bouncy castle can put you back £95,700 to be precise. But this is the Highways England trial up in Coventry somewhere, isn't it?
Yeah, Keir, I think. I mean, Highways England are taking the credit, but I think it's Keir's initiative, really.
Is it? Okay. I know it's on a Keir site. So tell us about this, because I think this is quite amusing.
Well, at first, when I saw the picture, they basically got this, I say, giant inflatable. What is it? Judging by the picture, is it maybe 10 or 12 foot high or something?
Yeah.
At first, it looked like it was an inflatable airbag because the idea is to keep road workers safe.
Yeah.
Instead of just being behind cones, they've got this giant airbag. And I thought at first the idea was that cars or lorries would
just
crash into the bouncy castle instead of into the people, the workers.
Unfortunately, it's not
reading. It's essentially an inflatable neon bright sign saying, don't crash here. It's to raise the visibility of the hazard of the roadworks in a more visible way than a few cones or a couple of tin signs would do. So it's just, big, bright, and bouncy.
You can see the benefit there, can't you? I mean, you can see the thinking behind it because, I mean, as you say, it's big. You can't miss it, and also it must be very imposing if you're bowling along the motorway and all of a sudden this enormous, great balloon-like thing looms up in front of you. You're going to hit the brake, aren't you? But if you don't hit the brake, or if you don't hit it fast enough, at least if you did make contact with this thing, it wouldn't do too much damage. Mind you, if you went through it, I suppose it would. But quite an interesting idea. Presumably, it works like a bouncy castle. It's got some sort of.
You know what? I don't even think it's that substantial. I suspect it's more.
Oh, really?
Like, if you ever see them at trade shows or in American films, they often use them in used car lots. These kind of very, very tall, stick insect cartoon inflatable.
Oh, I
men
see. Yes,
that wave in the wind at you and bow around because a hairdryer blows hot air up them from underneath, and they sort of just to attract attention to passers by. Something billowing in the wind. So I don't think it's a substantial structure. like a bouncy castle at all.
It has no physically protective
function.
No.
And if it was like that, you wouldn't be able to move. It'd have the disadvantage of not being so easy to move around. I mean, if it's a light, just effectively a balloon.
You'd have to tether it pretty well, because you wouldn't want that blowing across the motorway, would you? That would be rather counterproductive, I think.
Yes. I'm still not sure how it costs $95,700, but it's come from Harris England research budget, one of their pots of money for innovation. Have funded it.
Is it just the one, or have they got several of these on this?
I believe it's just the one at the moment, and they're going to see how it pans out over the next, month, and see whether it justifies getting more of them.
If there are any drivers in the Coventry area who have actually seen this inflatable sign, I'd quite like to hear from them and get their opinions on it, whether it was as big and noticeable as I imagine it's intended to be, and whether or not they think it would work from a driver's point of view. I don't know whether or not Kia obviously will have a view on it as well.
For those in the Coventry area, unless it's been moved already, it's at the A45, A46 interchange. Stivical? I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce that place. But that's where it started life. It does rather remind me of the inflatable boy who took a pin to the inflatable school, only to be told by the headmaster that you've let me down, you've let yourself down, you've let the whole school down.
Yeah.
So let's hope that doesn't happen in Coventry.
I think that probably that wraps it up for today, don't you think, Phil?
I think it does. What should we talk about next week? Should we give a sneak preview of next week's conversation?
I've got no idea what it is. You obviously know more than me, Phil.
Next week we'll be talking about the future, folks, but by then it won't be.
Indeed.
Well, thank you everyone for listening to Reconstruction. That's all we've got time for this week, but we'll be back again next week, David and I. And if you want to read anything more about what we've been talking about, a good place to start is theconstructionindex.co.uk. But from David and I, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news every day, visit theconstructionindex.co.uk.